L is the abbreviated, not a nickname, don't think of it that way, but the abbreviated form of the word for God, Elohim. And so, remember, Daniel means, notice the syllables, Daniel means God is my judge. Mishael means who is what God is. Yah, not a nickname, but an abbreviated form of Yahweh. So Hananiah is Hananiah, and I didn't do all the syllables there, but Hananiah means Yahweh has been gracious. And Azariah, Azariah means Yahweh has helped. What beautiful names. And this is really important. Here's a question for you. Did these names make them members of God's covenant people? No. We know the answer is no, of course not. There wasn't anything magical in the name. So that by changing their names, they're now less a part of God's people than they were before. As though the chief of the eunuchs had some power by giving you a new name to make you not God's people anymore. It's not that way. Their names were just a way of celebrating their identity. They were a constant reminder of who they were as members of the people God chose for himself. Does that matter? Is that beautiful? That means something, but yet they're not magical. By taking them away, it doesn't mean I'm not his people. I'm not one of his people. So now we need to ask ourselves this question. And I think it's the question Daniel had to ask himself. When Nebuchadnezzar gives them new names, honoring Babylonian gods, and symbolizing this new identity he expects them to take. Okay? So Nebuchadnezzar knows what he's doing. He knows why he's giving them new names. How should Daniel and his three friends respond? What will it look like to live life skillfully in that situation? What do you think? On the one hand, since it is not their names that make their identity, it's really not the end of the world, is it? There's a sense in which we can rightfully say it's what? Just a name. That's all it is. It's just a name. So, throughout the book of Daniel, Daniel and his three friends have no problem responding to these new Babylonian names. In fact, Daniel even refers to himself by his Babylonian name if it keeps things simpler. So, Daniel 4:19. The king answered and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation alarm you. So he calls him Belteshazzar. Belteshazzar answered and said, my Lord, may the dream be for those who hate you. Now, this is somewhat, I want you to know, I never say something, ever, specifically, to be funny. And I mean, that's important to me. I mean, I want to get a laugh out of you. If it's funny, that's fine. But there's a serious point here. So even if we find this humorous sounding, I want us to hear the serious point in it. So Belteshazzar, now we're all afraid to laugh, don't worry about it, but Belteshazzar doesn't say to Nebuchadnezzar, that's not my name, right? And until you call me Daniel, I'm not going to tell you the interpretation of your dream. That's not what Daniel does. Look, he answers. We see a similar example with Daniel's three friends, Daniel 3. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace, and he declared, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I'm thinking, that's not their names. Servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Daniel refers to them by those names, came out from the fire. So they didn't say, those aren't our names. Until you call us Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, we're not coming out of the fire. That's not what they do. They answer. Daniel and his three friends in your handout accepted the fact that these were the names by which the Babylonians were going to call them. They would even respond to these names without any objections. At the end of the day, it is not what others choose to call them that determines who they really are, where their loyalty and allegiance really lies. And yet, now, is it really that simple? And yet, do their names not matter at all? Clearly they do, because the Babylonians are changing them. The Babylonians are giving them new names. This matters. Does this mean that except for sentimental attachments, and we can get that, I was attached to my old name, and I mean, it's who I was for so long. Daniel and his friends, should they have no objections to these new names that have been given them in honor of the Babylonian gods? How far should we really be able to go in telling ourselves it's just a name? How far? Skillful living? That's what this is about. And I believe the answer to that question is this: only so far as wisdom and the strength of our love and devotion to the Lord will allow. Yes, Daniel could have said, just a name, what's the difference? From now on, my name is Belteshazzar, because I know it doesn't really change anything. Technically, that might be true, but practically, what might that be revealing about the strength of Daniel's love and devotion to the Lord? Especially in the culture of Daniel's day, especially in the midst of exile. When I'm truly devoted to the Lord, when I am cherishing my identity as a member of His chosen people, question, what will it mean to me? When my name is changed from Daniel to Belteshazzar, Bel, protect the king. From Hananiah to Shadrach, which possibly means the command of Aku, the moon god of Babylon, or the command of Marduk. From Mishael to Meshach, which possibly means, if Mishael means who is what God is, Meshach possibly means who is what Aku is. From Azariah to Abednego, servant of Nebo, or Nevo, god of agriculture. And it's just a name on the one hand, so I can accept that others are going to call me by that name. I don't have any control over that. It doesn't make me who I am. But can I ever really be at peace with that name? Can I? It's just a name. But because of the strength of my devotion to the Lord, I simply cannot. And I put it this way, no matter how hard I might ever try, I cannot and must not own that name myself. I'm going to come back to this word often in the message, conviction. Conviction. I wonder, is there a lack of the sense of conviction in the church today? I'm not talking about legalism. We're going to see Daniel is not legalistic here. But conviction. So it appears that Belteshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are not actually the names that Nebuchadnezzar's chief eunuch gave to these four young men. This is something that I had not been aware of before. But all of these names are so difficult to make sense of where they would have come from or what they mean, except for two of them, that a number of scholars and commentators have concluded they were deliberately altered and corrupted, basically misspelled by Daniel. It's like this little, I don't like that name, so I'm going to misspell it. Right? So it seems likely that the real name Daniel was given to Daniel was Belshazzar, which we see later is the name of one of the kings, and not the misspelled and corrupted Belteshazzar. It's a little form of maybe not mockery, but well, we'll see what that is in a minute. The real name given to Azariah was probably Abednego, or sometimes the B as the V sound, Abednego. and not the purposefully altered Abednego. Remember Nebuchadnezzar? We have that Nebu from the name of his god. And so Abednego or Nebo would have fit perfectly with that. Nego doesn't make any sense, except that it sounds kind of like Nebo. The other names are even more difficult, so it's even more impossible to guess at the original names probably behind them. So what is Daniel doing here? So we could look at Daniel and say, what are you doing? Is he overreacting? Is he making a big deal out of nothing, a mountain out of the molehill? What do you think? What do you think? Daniel twists and misspells the names, especially the parts of the names that identify the gods. Not because he thinks a name has some magical power to make him who he is. That's not why. He does this only because of the depth of his love and devotion to the Lord, the only true God. And also because he wisely recognizes what the real threat is. The real threat is not the name, it's what this name change represents. He recognizes that real threat and that real danger of exile. Because of that love and devotion, in the midst of the threat of exile, these names grieve him. He can't say, oh, it's just a name, who cares? Anyone who gets hung up over that, man, you got a problem. No, Daniel is hung up over it. They grieve him. Because of that love and devotion in the midst of the threat of exile, when Daniel writes these names himself, he never fails to misspell them as an expression of his rejection of all that these so-called gods are totally powerless to save. If we're not convinced by the misspelling, which I've seen is a pretty unanimous consensus that they are purposefully corrupted, there's also this. Because of Daniel's love and devotion, in the midst of the threat of exile, it's the Hebrew names, Daniel, Mishael, Azariah, Hananiah, that these four youths continue to own as their only true names. So, you know, we go on in chapter 1 and we read in verse 11, then Daniel said to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over who? Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Verse 19, the king spoke with him, and among all them none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Verse 17, Daniel went to his house, made the matter known. When he was at home, he called him Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Because it matters. The names Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are used only in chapter 3. And you know why they're used there? It's in the context where these three young men are being spoken about and spoken to by Babylonians. So that's why it's used there. But I asked myself this question, I'll ask you, did you ever wonder if Daniel would be disappointed today that most of us are far more familiar with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego than we are with Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah? We're going to hear the name Belteshazzar 9 more times in the book of Daniel. It really was his new name, and they called him that. Every time, though, it's going to be a context where it's prefaced something like this. It's amazing in Daniel, the emphasis on names. The king declared to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, so Daniel 10:1, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a word was revealed to Daniel. Look, I'm going to use that name. But who was named Belteshazzar? At last, Daniel came in before me. And I wonder if Nebuchadnezzar uses this name now because he's just been amazed by Daniel's God. He who was named Belteshazzar after the name of my God. And I told him the dream, saying, O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, tell me the visions of my dream that I saw in their interpretation. O Belteshazzar, tell me the interpretation. And then all of a sudden, after Belteshazzar, Belteshazzar, then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar. I mean, can't we just, we know, we know. Right? Or can't we just do the Belteshazzar, since that's what's here going on? You see this emphasis on the name. Now, after we're told of the new name given to Daniel, Belteshazzar, only 9 more times do we hear that. Daniel, we hear 73 more times in the book of Daniel. So, for Daniel, the name change didn't take. It's specifically this name that Daniel emphasizes and even takes special pleasure in. I just had fun discovering this, looking at this, seeing, look what Daniel does, chapter 7. As for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious. Later in the same chapter, so we know who's talking, we know this is Daniel. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me. In the third year, a vision appeared to me, Daniel. Later in the same chapter, we certainly still know who he's talking about, I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for some days. In the first year, I, Daniel, perceived in the books. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning for 3 weeks. I, Daniel, alone saw the vision. Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold. I don't know offhand of any other book where anyone emphasizes his name like this. Even Nehemiah, where he speaks in the first person. Not only does Daniel go to extra lengths to refer to himself by this name, but I think this is beautiful. Look, the angelic messenger from God even emphasizes that name. Oh, Daniel, I have now come out to give you insight and understanding. Oh, Daniel, man greatly loved. Then one verse later, fear not, Daniel. But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book. And then, just a few verses later, so we know he's still talking to, go your way, Daniel. So, one commentator writes this. It appears that in the Babylonians' attempt to give the Judean youths a new identity, a new allegiance, they bestowed names that associate them with Babylonian gods. Now listen to what he says next. The remarkable fact is that the Hebrew youths did not choose to fight this battle. And how do we respond to that? We say yes and no. Yes and no. That's true to a point, but it's not the full picture. Yes. Daniel and his friends can accept that others are going to call them by these names. They can answer to these names without objection or without their conscience being bothered because they're just names. That's all they are. That's the battle they're not going to fight. And yet, they cannot. They simply cannot own these names themselves. Because on the other hand, they're not just names. They're not. They are a constant affront to these Hebrew youths, 14 and 15 years old, to their most deeply held convictions and identity. Does it matter? These names are a constant representation of the threat of exile that's all around them. And so the point here is not just sentimentality. On the one hand, I miss my old name. Neither is the point legalism, which would be these names have power of their own, and so it's sinful to have them, even to answer to them. It's not that either. What is it? It's theology. It's devotion. Devotion. It's wisdom. It's conviction. The Christian life is about this. Because of their love and devotion to the Lord in the midst of the threat of exile, because of how they cherished, I mean, when you cherish your identity as members of God's covenant people, well, then there is a battle here that these 14-year-olds are willing to fight. even with respect to their names. Are you beginning to see in this what skillful living looks like? So we read in verse 7, the chief of the eunuch gave them names. That sounds innocent enough, I suppose, but if you look closer, the normal word that's used for naming someone is kara. It means to call. So maybe you're familiar with this expression in the Bible. So he called his name Solomon. That's their naming formula. He called his name. It's used for naming someone 95 times in the Old Testament. Four times there's a different word used, and you can already guess that here in Daniel, it's a different word. So seem means to set or put or place something. And I'm just going to skip ahead. We don't need to look at all those verses. I'm just going to say that to set a name in all the places, the three other places where that's used, it has the idea of someone setting a name on someone, making a statement. Okay? And so the only other place where that's used here is here in Daniel. And it says, the chief of the eunuchs set for them names. And I think we can go to the next one. Sorry, I just kind of blew over a bunch of stuff there. Oh, maybe, there it is. Great, great. And I've put the Hebrew up there so you can see something in a moment. Wa yosem. It means, and he set. Okay, the chief of the eunuchs set. When Daniel uses this expression, unusual as it is, he's trying to communicate something ominous to us. Like this name change matters. The chief of the eunuchs doesn't just call them by new names, he sets for them new names. And so what Daniel perceives in this renaming is an attack on his identity as one of God's people. He perceives in the renaming the Babylonian intention to absorb him and assimilate him into their pagan culture. What he perceives is the inescapable threat and the danger of exile. So I'll ask this, do we perceive the same threat? You can't live skillfully if you don't perceive the threat that requires us to live skillfully. Right? Do we see that? I can't live skillfully my life if I don't perceive by wisdom the threat of exile that requires me to live skillfully. We go on to read in verse 8, but Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Anyone already guess where this is going? Daniel resolved. Anyone guess the Hebrew behind that word? Literally, it is this. But Daniel set his heart. That's one of those powerful places where it's just worth knowing what the Hebrew does. And so you can see, Wayasem, Wayasem. The contrast between the two. The chief of the eunuchs sets for them names in response to this. Daniel, the 14-year-old, sets his heart. What was the problem with eating the king's food or drinking the king's wine? Did it have something to do with unclean animals that God commanded his people not to eat? Maybe it did. But wine is never mentioned in the food laws of Israel. And Daniel specifically sets his heart not to defile himself with the wine the king drinks. So it's difficult to say, well, he's doing it because of the food laws. Does it have something to do with the king's food having been sacrificed to idols? Maybe. Even there, I don't know that there's chapter and verse that says you can't eat that if you're an exile in another land. But even so, the grains and the fruits and the vegetables that Daniel requests, which I'm getting ahead of myself, when it says in our Bibles that he wanted just to eat vegetables, the idea is vegetation. The idea is something that grows out of the ground. So grains and fruits and vegetables would all be included. Most of these also would have been likely to have been offered to idols. They didn't just offer meat and animals to their gods. They offered grain offerings and drink offerings as well. So later on in chapter 10, we're going to see that the 83-year-old Daniel had no objections to eating meat or drinking wine in Babylon. So what is Daniel so concerned about? It's a big question. Notice the emphasis on the fact that this is the king's food and the wine that the king drank. Okay? He would not defile himself with the king's food, with the wine that he drank. Aside from Daniel 1, the only other place where we find that word for food is in Daniel 11. It's not going to be on the screen. But it talks about the king of the south and how even those who eat his food were going to rise up against him. The point is that those who enjoy eating the king's food are normally the people most loyal to the king, his closest associates, those who are most loyal to him. So try to put yourself in Daniel's shoes. This 14-year-old Daniel's shoes. Nebuchadnezzar, quoting someone here, Nebuchadnezzar has just defiled the temple in Jerusalem. He has plundered its utensils. Daniel is about to undergo a process of induction into Babylonian culture, including its religion. His name has been changed from one extolling the God of Israel to one invoking a Babylonian deity. And I ask then, how then can Daniel bring himself to sit down and enjoy the meat and the wine and all the rich, dainty foods that come from this pagan king's table? Is Daniel overreacting? Man, he needs a lesson in legalism, doesn't he? Is he making a big deal out of nothing? Because at the end of the day, it's not the food he eats that determines who he is or where his loyalties really lie, is it? And yet, does the food he eats not matter at all? Yes, Daniel could have said, it's just the king's food. What's the difference? I can eat the king's food. I know it doesn't change anything. Technically, yes, that's true. And maybe in some circumstances, as we'll see, maybe it's all right to eat the food. In fact, Jehoiachin, who was one of the kings we talked about a couple weeks ago, he was taken off to Babylon as prisoner of Nebuchadnezzar. The Bible talks about how he was set free and Nebuchadnezzar graciously set him free and he ate at the Babylonian king's table for the rest of his days. It's not all cut and dried. It's not all just like, this is what you always do, this is what you always don't do, and here's the rules. But here in Daniel's case, because of the realities of his circumstances and his conviction, his devotion to the Lord, practically speaking, if Daniel had said, hey, it's just food, what might that have revealed about his love and devotion to the Lord? Especially in the culture of his day, especially in the context of that threat of exile. Are you seeing what skillful living looks like? Maybe you're saying, no, I'm not. Right? Tell me what it is. That's skillful living, is we live it in the day-to-day outworking of our devotion to the Lord. For Daniel, when he sets his heart on this, it's not just a way of avoiding defilement. And how much of our life is focused on avoiding guilt, on avoiding the defilement, and not, as it was for Daniel here, on positively expressing and making concrete my loyalty and devotion to the God of Israel. Do you see the difference? Right? Daniel could have said, I got to avoid defilement. No, it was more than that for Daniel. Daniel wanted to positively express and make concrete his devotion to the Lord, which was being threatened in exile. And this was a way to do it. I want to challenge us, don't just live our lives seeking to avoid the guilt. Let's live our lives seeking to express and make concrete our devotion and love to the Lord. Even in ways that aren't in themselves moral. Now, if I started listing what those were and what you had to do, that'd be legalism, yeah. But this is a way for Daniel to proactively fight back. Not against the Babylonian officials, as we'll see. They are not the real enemy. That's wisdom, to see that they're not the real enemy. but rather against that constant threat of assimilation, of being squeezed into the mold of the pagan culture that's all around him. So what are the ways that we choose to do this today? As we live, just like Daniel, in exile with all the threats and all the dangers that this exile brings. I want to ask this question. Do we know what it is to live based on conviction? How much of our life is the outworking and the outflow of deeply rooted, deeply held conviction? Or do we seek to avoid, only to avoid any awareness of guilt? I struggle with whether to give any examples, because then it sounds like legalism. But this won't be, I don't believe. And so one thing that I want to challenge us on is in the issue of modesty in dress. What I feel like at times is that when it comes to dress, we're not people of conviction. Not truly. When it comes to dress, we perhaps confuse conviction with, I don't feel embarrassed to wear this. Or I feel pretty and cute in this, and I don't feel embarrassed to wear this, therefore it's acceptable. Now I'm not gonna go anywhere in saying, well, what is the conviction that others should have? My only point is that we be people of conviction. And that all that we do flows from conviction. And that's still going to mean, I have no doubts, that some are going to wear things that I wouldn't have worn. You know, not that I would wear, but that's still going to mean, it doesn't mean for me that everyone's going to be wearing what I would approve of. That's not the point. The point is simply conviction. So I know that, you know, fathers, as we raise our daughters, and you know, we want to model that ourselves. I think of other examples, which I get maybe even I'll throw it out there, the reason I'm afraid to is because I don't want you to think I'm judging anyone who does it. See, that's what I was talking with my kids about. As soon as you get to conviction and people living out their conviction, well, what if one of Daniel's companions had said, "Well, I really think it's all right. It's just a name," and Daniel has a conviction, and so he keeps misspelling it. You know, he keeps using his other name, or when it comes to food, he says, "I'm going to take a stand here and not eat." And they said, "Well, it's just the king's food. What do you expect us to do? We're living in exile. We're going to starve to death if we don't eat this. Does really God really intend us not to do that?" You know, it's easy to think, well, Daniel now is the hyper-judgmental, hyper-goody-two-shoes, hyper-spiritual person, and his convictions are now judging me, and that shouldn't be. Okay. But one of the things I struggle with is Halloween. And thinking that through, and one of our kids this morning said, it seems like there's two sides of Halloween. There's the innocent little kids who go door to door and get candy and are dressed up as innocent things. And then there's all the rest of Halloween. What does it mean that I have to ask myself in light of that? That's a reality. That's true. Living in this culture, living in a culture that's always seeking to assimilate us and absorb us, we recognize, we perceive that threat by wisdom. What is my devotion to God, the God of life, the God of the resurrection, the God who has conquered death as death being the punishment and the curse that came because of our sin. What does all of that mean for my participation in a holiday that today celebrates death? I see that never more than when we're camping every October and everyone like loves celebrating Halloween on their campgrounds. We know that in times past, it was even in the church, it was that celebration of the dead saints. And so we wonder, we ask, what will that mean? It's going to mean something different for you than for me. I have no doubts. But what about conviction? Well, therefore, in verse 8, we're going to move very quickly now through the rest of this chapter. Therefore, Daniel asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. I just can go back. We were walking in downtown Morris, and there's a coffin. There's a coffin up as decoration, a real coffin. You know, you walk, and I see amputated limbs hanging from places. I see skeletons. I see witches. And yet there's that innocent part of Halloween, too. And so there's where we have to recognize it's not a black and white thing in and of itself. At various times and various situations in history and culture and whatever else, where you are. But what does conviction look like? Just make sure it's conviction. Maybe handing out. Some people say, my conviction is I can't even hand anything out. Others say, well, I can't hand something out. I'll look good to tract with it. Conviction, skillful living. Chapter 1, verse 8. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. Look at this. Is Daniel like up on his high horse? Clearly not. He handles himself with tact and humility, with wisdom. He asks the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. See, that tells me here that this wasn't a cut and dried thing. If it was about not bowing down to the idol, I'm not sure what that looks like. What if the chief of the eunuchs had refused Daniel's request? You ever think about that? Was Daniel going to go to the stake for that? I'm not sure that he would have. I'm not sure what he would have done, because I don't know what wisdom would have looked like in that situation. But in any case, it's not what happened. Happily, we read in verses 9 to 10, and God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. And that's not just rhetorical flourish at the end, right? He really would endanger his head with the king. That's the way they were back then. Some people still are, I'm sure. So if Daniel's appearance is subpar and it comes to light that the chief of the eunuchs gave him a different diet than what the king had prescribed, well, chief of the eunuchs might be dead. It's life forfeit. That's what makes it so amazing that he doesn't just say, Daniel, forget it. He doesn't deny it outright. Look what he does. He basically says to Daniel, I don't personally have a problem with that. If I knew you wouldn't suffer any bad physical effects or look bad at all, but I cannot give my official permission for fear I would lose my life. Now, how many of us at that point are like, okay, well, I tried. Right? Daniel sees, though, this isn't a reason to give up. It's every reason to continue. God has given me favor. Let me push it. Let me take it to the next step. Daniel has set his heart. So we read in verses 11 to 13. Then Daniel said to the steward and the chief of the eunuchs that assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. See how Daniel has scaled it back? First he said, can we not eat that food? Now he says, okay, 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat, water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. Once again, 14-year-old tact and wisdom, right? This time he goes to someone of lesser authority. Okay? He talked to the chief of the eunuchs, got what he had to say. Now he goes to the steward, having been permissioned to do that in so many words. He proposes a 10-day probationary period. They're given only grains, fruits, and vegetables, water to drink, and after that, the steward can either continue the diet or not, depending on what he sees. So we read in verses 14 to 16, "So the steward listened to them in this matter, tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food." Imagine the joy of Daniel. "So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them grains, fruits, and vegetables." Grains, fruits, and vegetables was just considered to be a lesser food. Meat was the quality food, right? Daniel set his heart not to eat the king's food or drink the king's wine. Not because he thought it had a magical power, or because there was a rule of scripture in a verse that said you can't do this. Daniel set his heart because of the depth of his love and devotion to the only true God, and that is not legalism. So often I think we look at someone who does that, we think, well, they got it deep down, there's a little bit of a problem with legalism. That is not legalism. Because he also perceived the real threat of exile. You could say that this was, I think sometimes it can be easy for us to say, well, the people who do these things, who have these standards, they're the weaker brothers, right? They think they can't, but they actually could. No, they're not always the weaker brothers. Sometimes they're just living out their devotion and love for the Lord in terms of conviction. And so this was Daniel's way of guarding himself from the danger of exile, of making his devotion concrete, and of guarding and maintaining it against that constant barrage of the pagan culture around him. What are the appropriate ways for you and I to do that today? There's no fixed formula here, is there? There's no formula. And yet Daniel does model for us what it looks like to live wisely, skillfully in exile. And so we come full circle to verses 17 to 20. "As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams." The point here is not that we're going to have understanding in visions and dreams. The point is, even more broadly, wisdom, this blessing and this gift. "At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them, and among all of them none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they stood before the king, and in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom." In verse 2, the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. In verse 9, God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. In verse 17, God gave Daniel and his three companions learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. All right. So behind this story, and behind all the history of all God's people, are always the sovereign, saving purposes of God. Okay. It is this greatness of God. Okay, because we don't want to forget that Daniel's not the main character in this story. It is God at work behind it. It is the greatness of this God as the only true God that calls you and me, just like Daniel, to set our hearts on never defiling ourselves with the king's food, on always guarding and maintaining. Even as we live in this world and recognize that the neighbors next door to us are not the enemy, even our Babylonian captors are not ultimately the enemy, right? But guarding and maintaining our distinctive, most precious identity as those who've been called and chosen by God through the gospel of His Son. That will teach you wisdom. The ability to truly live life skillfully is not something that can be learned in a textbook. It cannot be imparted that way. Instead, it is a gift that God gives freely. Isn't that encouraging? To 14-year-olds, right? It's a gift God gives freely to those who ask, to those who set their hearts on never defiling themselves with the king's food. It's a gift that God gives freely in the actual day-to-day living of our lives as we truly seek first after Him. See, that's the key. Setting our heart, seeking first. We see that in James 1. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. But let him ask in faith with no doubting. For the one who doubts, the one who isn't really sure that he really wants wisdom because of what it might mean, the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. I'm going to add something in here, but I want to here now conclude where we began. I just want to especially encourage all of the young people, whether you're 14 or 8 or 5, whatever age you may be. Remember that Daniel was 14. I mean, the Bible talks about Timothy as a youth, and he might have been older than, I'm sure he was old, I know he was older than 14, but setting an example and not letting anyone look down on his youth, but setting an example of the believer in humility. And I look at Daniel today, and I look at Daniel as a 41-year-old, and those older than me can look at Daniel, this 14-year-old, and see him setting an example to me. He set his heart not to defile himself with the king's food. And I would just encourage you with this. You are never, ever too young to live life wisely. It doesn't mean that you think I'm smarter than everyone else and I've got more wisdom than everyone else. No. Wisdom is humility, right? You're never too young to be characterized by conviction. Listen to what the psalmist writes, and this is not only for the young people, it's for all of us. I have more understanding than all my teachers, for your testimonies are my meditation. I understand more than the aged, for I keep your precepts. Dear Heavenly Father, we come to you together this morning and ask for wisdom. Help us, O Lord, not to confuse legalism with conviction, with making concrete the expression of our devotion and love to you and our cherishing of our identity as your called out special people in this world. Father, I just pray that most of all you give us the wisdom, the beginning of wisdom, which is the fear of you and the true insight into your sovereign saving purposes through our Lord Jesus Christ. And that from this then flows a life that's lived skillfully a life of conviction, a life of wisdom. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.